From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air.
Monday, Monday, so good to me.
I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, tune in, turn on, but don't drop out. Today we're revisiting the psychedelic era of 60s music. First, we hear from the late Bill Graham, one of rock's greatest promoters. Also, we listen back to an interview with the late John Phillips, the founder of the Mamas and the Papas. They had a string of hits, including this one, Monday, Monday. And singer Neil Young. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air.
Monday, Monday.
First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The baseball season is on today after team owners and players reached a tentative agreement to avert a strike. The players' union made concessions on two issues: a luxury tax designed to keep wealthier teams from spending so much to lure top players, and a plan to distribute more local revenue from wealthier teams to poorer ones. The two sides are expected to ratify the four-year agreement in about a week. Fans at Chicago's Wrigley Field welcomed the agreement, as Chicago Public Radio's Dan Blumberg reports.
If players had gone on strike, the game between the Chicago Cubs and St. Louis Cardinals would have been the first to be canceled. Just before entering the stadium gates, Carla Manner said it's terrific that the game will go on. She says if players did strike, she would never go to another game again. And she says explaining the potential strike to her children was not easy.
I told them we might go to the game if there's no strike, and my daughter, who is going on 11, said she thought it was a shame because she thinks baseball players are, you know, making a lot of money, and there's people who have nothing and are homeless, and they're not, you know, they're the people who need the money.
Vendors and business owners around Wrigley Field are also pleased that no games will be canceled. Some of them say they were already looking for other work in case of a strike. For NPR News, I'm Dan Blumberg in Chicago.
Federal air safety officials have ordered U.S. airlines to inspect about 1,400 Boeing jets to avert a potentially dangerous fuel pump problem. The Federal Aviation Administration said the pumps may have faulty wiring that could trigger an explosion. The FAA said the pumps were installed on some Boeing 737s, 747s, and 757s earlier this year. The problem was discovered earlier this month when three different airlines reported that the pumps shorted out. The air carriers have been given 4 days to inspect their fleets. On a visit to Lebanon, Iraq's vice president said his country wants to continue negotiating with the United Nations about the return of weapons inspectors. He blamed the suspension of talks on the United States. NPR's Kate Seeley reports from Beirut.
Iraqi Vice President Taha Yassin Ramadan held talks in Lebanon in an effort to build Arab support against a possible U.S. attack on Iraq. Later, in an interview with the Lebanese Broadcasting Corporation, Ramadan said his government wanted to continue talks with the United Nations. Iraq and the UN have met 3 times this year to discuss a return of arms inspectors to the country, but Ramadan said talks should not be confined to the issue of weapons inspectors. Iraq denies it has weapons of mass destruction and has been calling on the UN to lift the 12-year-old embargo on Baghdad. The UN is demanding the unconditional return of arms inspectors. Ramadan blamed the suspension of UN talks on the U.S., which he accused of pressuring the world body. Kate Seeley, NPR News, Beirut.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 7 points. The Nasdaq was down 20, or 1.5%. This is NPR News. The World Trade Organization has handed down its largest penalty ever, ruling that the European Union can impose up to $4 billion in trade sanctions on the United States in a tax dispute. Douglas Baxton has more.
The sanctions are 20 times the amount levied in any previous WTO dispute. The ruling involves a U.S. program known as the Foreign Sales Corporations, which allows American companies with a foreign presence to exempt up to 30% of their export income from U.S. taxes. This means companies pay less tax, which makes their products cheaper and gives them an advantage over foreign competitors. The EU estimates its companies are losing $4 billion in trade annually. Washington puts the figure at $1 billion. It is not clear whether the EU will soon take action. EU officials have said they are more interested in Washington eliminating the tax breaks than in retaliation. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Maxion in Luxembourg City.
The machinists' union at Boeing says it will hold a new vote on the company's final contract offer and will keep its workers on the job after the current contract expires next Tuesday. The union, which represents 26,000 aircraft machinists, agreed to conduct a new vote after the company questioned the validity of the first ballot. Earlier this week, federal mediators sought to intervene in the negotiations, saying a strike at the giant aircraft company could cause substantial disruption to the economy. Boeing said the proposal of federal mediation should not have come while the workers were voting on the company's final offer, because it may have misled union members into changing their votes. In stocks today, the S&P 500 lost about 2 points to close at 916. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kauffman Center for Entrepreneurial Leadership, celebrating its 10th anniversary and proudly sponsoring Fast Track for starting and growing businesses.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. On today's Archive Edition, we continue with our 60s Music Week.
Four gentlemen and one great, great roar. Big Brother.
Bill Graham came up with the idea of turning old theaters into rock venues. From 1968 to 1971, he operated the Fillmore in San Francisco and the Fillmore East in New York. Graham died in 1991 in a helicopter crash on the way home from a Huey Lewis concert, which he had promoted. He was 60 years old. We remember him now with an interview Terry recorded with him in San Francisco in 1989. It was there he first made his mark as the rock promoter of the psychedelic scene. Bill Graham eventually branched out into every aspect of rock promotion and was a producer of several groundbreaking international benefits, like Live Aid and the Amnesty International concert tours. He told Terry that when he opened the Fillmore, a lot of people who came to the concerts resented the idea that they had to buy tickets.
Music was chosen by the mass to be free, because to a great extent, it was free in the park on the weekends, and it was very difficult to tell the public also that many of the shows that were staged on the weekends, we provided the sound and the lights from the profits that we earned from the Fillmore. But the word business, any connotation of business or the law, the cops, the pigs, the fuzz, was a negative aspect of our society.
Well, how did you deal with that as a businessman? Did you feel like you had to defend yourself and defend making a profit?
It was by far the most difficult time of my life, the most joyous, because it was all new and was fresh, and there were no blueprints in how to run these kinds of concerts and how to deal with the public. The difficulty was in having the patrons look at me as perhaps the enemy, or if it wasn't for people like you, music would be free, and trying to explain to them that in order for music to be free, all the other elements that go into the concert must be free. Trucking must be free. Electricity, telephones, transportation, getting the artists to the facility, and all the people that work here would have to have other means of income. But we all need to deal with the reality of life. Dealing with that reality at that time with the power to the people syndrome was at times very debilitating, and being the point man was very unpleasant.
Did you get into philosophical debates with audiences and with rock musicians about
every
how much
day.
Profit was the appropriate amount of profit
every
to take?
Day there wasn't There wasn't a day that went by. Why is the ticket price that high? Why isn't it free? Or the whole spare change, and why can't I get in free when I don't have the funds? But I would always challenge anybody's forceful attempt to enter a facility because they felt it was their right that this should be free. Because invariably I'd say, what does your father do? And if he was a plumber or a baker, I said, well, I'd like to get my plumbing fixed for free. I'd like some bread for free, and tell me your father's address. And that hit a stone wall. But it took years to get over the past that.
Was there a difference between the way you were running your operation and the way people from the counterculture who were producing concerts were running it?
Well, there were other people who were very sincere in their approach also. One of the things that I tried to do is to bring in music that they didn't ask for, but music that I know was important and became very important to me, if it was Latin or jazz or R&B. And knowing that The Airplane or The Dead or Quicksilver would sell all the tickets, I wouldn't have to worry about the draw. Mm-hmm. So I was able to go to Chuck Berry or the Staples Singers, as I said. And yet these artists had become, the film became relatively famous rather quickly. But it became famous as a psychedelic place, and that's where you, my God, if certain people touch you, you're never going to be the same. When we had the strobe lights there and the light shows. So it wasn't that easy to convince these artists. And eventually I had to go to Wentzville, Missouri to talk to Chuck directly. I went to Macon, Georgia to talk to Otis Redding to convince him to come out. And when they did come out, the audience was their acceptance to this day. My fondest memories of this business are watching a predominantly white audience look at Chuck Berry or look at the Staples Singers and look at Albert King or B.B. King or Buddy Guy and Junior Wells. Or we would bring in, we did a show once with The Birds and two one-act plays by Leroy Jones. Another time we did a show with the Russian poet Andrei Voznesensky and Jefferson Airplane, and watching the Russian ladies listen to the poetry and then watching them listening to rock and rolls. It was all new for me, and it was all new for them, and it was the most exciting time of my life.
As the businessman in the rock world, you were dealing with a lot of groups who were getting high a lot and who were into the counterculture. I'm talking about the late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. Were there a lot of groups who wanted to turn you on and see what happened?
Yeah.
That actually happened once, didn't it?
It's happened more than once, but it happened one time in particular where it was the only time that I ever knowingly lost it to some extent, just went with it. Yeah.
This is the Grateful Dead story?
Yeah.
7-Up, was it?
Yeah.
Tell us what happened.
They played the Fillmore quite often, and there was always, come on, Bill, let's get happy together. And I had a very strong rule about my work life, that during working hours, I was straight, and I expected everybody that worked at the Fillmore to be the same. And I pushed that very strongly, because we need to be clean and clear to deal with the public and the artists. And I have no right to tell them what they need to do, as long as they were civil and relatively humane. And in those days, I drank a lot of 7-Up. Just it was my liquid of that era. And it had gotten to a point where my wife, when I went to work at Dead shows, when they played the Fillmore, would pack my lunch and put it in a bag and put a wax seal on it and take my thermos and just make sure that everything that I had wasn't tampered with, which is true. And I'd break the seal and have my lunch and touch nothing else there. except some 7-Ups, but nothing else. Wouldn't eat anything there. And this particular evening when they were playing at the place, I walked into their dressing room, and it was just a habit. I would always walk in, go to one of the tubs that we had that was full of 7-Up and Coca-Cola and whatnot, and have a drink. And they knew this, so this particular night, unbeknownst to me, someone, who I eventually came to find out who that was, someone had taken a hypodermic needle and stuck it through the cans of 7-Up in this particular bucket, and nobody else touched them. They said, that's the Graham lair. That's where he's going to dip in. And sure enough, I picked up a can of 7-Up, and about a half hour later, I was on my way to Mars. And I felt very good and felt very much at ease and felt very elated and very riding on a carpet. And Mickey Hart in the band asked if
this
I wanted
the drummer
to,
from the yeah, Grateful Dead.
If I wanted to come on stage with the guys, and I said no. You know, I just introduced the band. He said, "Well, we'll only play if you come on stage, and here's a drumstick, and why don't you lead the band, and tell us what songs you want to hear, and whatever that is, we'll just play that, and we'll keep going all night long." Well, that night I conducted this the band from the stage the whole night, and just hit the cymbals, you know, and hit the barbells, and played the cowbell, and it was by far the most uninhibited night of my life.
Were you embarrassed or liberated
Not
the day after?
The day after, I just wondered if I had made a total ass of myself. But I didn't think I did, and I didn't remember that I did, and never went beyond the context of doing what they invited me to do. I didn't go beyond that. I didn't try to sing. I didn't try to shout, and I didn't try to dance. I just I know their songs quite well. And just picked some songs, and they played them. It was a joyous event. It really was.
Did it change your life in any way?
No.
No?
But I had already become a fan of that scene. Not just the music, but the fact that these people, that the group never used props, to this day, doesn't use props. They don't wear tight pants. There are no hydraulic lifts. There's no tumbling drum set, and the people come into a space, they're all doves, and they basically come to enjoy themselves and partake in a sort of union. And I'm very much in favor of that.
Bill Graham speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. Coming up, the man who wrote the songs Monday Monday and California Dreamin'. This is Fresh Air.
Wow, thing. You make my heart sing. You make forever.
John Phillips, the co-founder of the 60s folk pop group The Mamas and the Papas, wrote or co-wrote several of the group's hits, including California Dreamin', Monday Monday, Words of Love, I Saw Her Again Last Night, and Straight Shooter. He also wrote the Scott McKenzie hit San Francisco. He not only wrote the songs about the 60s counterculture, he was a producer of one of the decade's landmark events, the Monterey Pop Festival. Phillips died of heart failure last year at the age of 65. New York Times rock critic Neil Strauss writes, "Phillips was a man of many contradictions, idealist, hedonist, businessman, musician." Terry Gross spoke with John Phillips in 1986. Before we hear that interview, let's play a song he co-wrote that tells the story of the Mamas and the Papas.
John and Mitchie were getting kind of itchy just to leave the folk music behind. Saul and Denny working for a penny, trying to get a fish on the line.
In a coffee house Sebastian sat, and after every number they passed the hat.
McGuinn and McGuire's just getting higher in L.A., you know where that's at.
And no one's getting fat except Mama Cass.
Saul is a Danny, you know there aren't many who can sing a song the way that you do. Let's go south.
Danny says, "Olly golly, don't you think that I wish I could play guitar like you?"
Saul, Danny, and Sebastian sat
at the night out,
and after every number they passed the hat.
McGuinn and McGuire still are getting higher.
And no one's getting fat except Mama Cass.
The members of the Mamas and the Papas were John Phillips, Michelle Phillips, Denny Doherty, and Cass Elliott, who was known as Mama Cass. John Phillips told Terry Gross how Cass joined the group.
We were in the Virgin Islands, and Michelle and Denny and I were singing on stage as the journeyman, the new journeyman, and Cass was waiting tables in this restaurant and trying to convince us that she could sing with us, you know. a wonderful singer like Cass, you know, waiting the tables, and we're up there singing, and she's trying to convince us that to let her join the group, and we're saying, no, your range is too low. They were doing some construction work there, and a workman happened to drop a 6-inch lead pipe, and it landed on Cass's head from 30 feet up, and it gave her a concussion, and she went to the hospital for a couple of days, and she came back, and for some reason, she was able to sing a tone and a half, two tones higher than she had when she went in the hospital. And from then on, her voice fitted in perfectly into the harmonies.
You write in your book about how surprised you were the first time you saw her because she was so big. Did you ever go through this thing of thinking, how would she look on stage, and would it be bad for the group's image to have someone who was really fat in the group?
No, that never occurred to me, but it sure occurred to Cass. I mean, Cass said she would never go on stage on the same stage as Michelle, because Michelle was so slim and so pretty, and Cass felt that she looked awful next to Michelle, but she looked all right with a couple of guys around there, but not anywhere near Michelle. And it took us a long time to convince Cass to go on stage and to perform live with Michelle as her singing partner. But the first time she did it, and she realized that Michelle had beauty and all this, but that Cass really had the warmth and the personality and could just grab the audience with her vocal ability, things that Michelle couldn't do. From then on, Cass was like, what's the big problem here, you know? Get this little thing out of here. I'll take care of everything.
Michelle, who you referred to, was your second wife, and you met her mm-hmm. just to fill everybody in when you were about 26 or something.
Yeah, I was about 26, and she was about 16.
And you married her. You left your first wife for her. And,
yeah.
And ended up performing together, even though she didn't initially plan on going into music. Why did you decide to include her in the group? Because she hadn't been a performer.
No, as a matter of fact, she'd grown up in Mexico, and she'd never sung professionally at all. But we would go on these long road trips with the journeymen, and she would always travel with us. And we would sing in the car. And as this went on for like 3 years, you know, being on the road, and she just got better and better and better. And she had a real street sense of rock and roll. She had a better street sense of rock and roll than Cass had. Cass had an incredible technique and tone and all these things. Michelle really had that sort of Phil Spector kind of, you know, the Ronettes kind of, you know, or the Shangri-Las or something like that. You know, she would have fit right into that group perfectly. So it was a nice balance of technique and raw talent between the two of them.
What was your concept for the group in terms of the production of the record and the vocal harmonies that you were working?
Well, my influences were these other groups who had been so extremely musical. And I'd always liked the sound of men and women singing together. So I wanted to, have a group that was two guys and two girls and that would have featured soloists and a lot of answer-back harmonies and things like that, you know. And Lou Adler was very responsible for taking what I did with just one guitar and vocal arrangements. I mean, we could sing anything live, you know, because everyone knew how to sing and all that. But he found, like, the best musicians on the West Coast and put them behind us, like really good rock musicians like Hal Blaine and Larry Nechtel and Joe Osborne and people like that. And the mixture of those things, once again, it was like, you know, that's where Lou's genius as a producer really lies, in finding someone who can really write good songs, someone who can really sing well, and then get a great band and put it all together. And that's what a producer should do, you know.
Some producers who see the potential in a band then dress them up in all kinds of arrangements that they don't fit into.
Yeah.
Did you have to fight for that at all? He had a good sense of what would be good for you?
Yeah, he just left us alone. As a matter of fact, like California Dreaming was originally done as a track for Barry McGuire. And when Lou heard the song, he thought that'd be a great follow-up for Barry for Eve of Destruction.
I can't see that, actually.
Well, it didn't work out. But that original track and the original background vocals were cut for a Barry McGuire album. And then it's on Barry's album, as a matter of fact, with the Mamas and Papas singing all the backgrounds on that album. But it just didn't sound right. And then Lou said to himself, well, why don't you let, well, we'll have Denny sing it also, you know. And Denny sings an octave higher than Barry. And he put Denny on it, and all of a sudden it went boom, into this beautiful sound. And that's how California Dreaming was actually made. It was made for Barry McGuire.
But then it was remade for...
It wasn't remade. I mean, we put the lead on top of the track we did for Barry.
Oh, so just right on top of it.
Yeah.
That's really amazing.
It took Barry's voice off and put Denny's on, and that was it.
As soon as the moms and papas signed a 5-year contract, which wedded them together for 5 years, things started to break apart in the group a little bit. It was right after you signed the contract, right, that you found out your lover, Michelle, was actually sleeping with Denny from the group.
Yeah.
that must have been really devastating.
It was, yeah. It was very hard. It wasn't just my lover, Michelle. It was my wife, Michelle, by that point.
Yeah. Even
We'd
worse.
We'd gone past that point, yeah. It was Denny's lover, my wife. What it really was. It was sort of devastating, you know, and Cass was, you know, deeply in love with Denny, and Denny loved Cass as a brother and sister sort of thing, you know, and gosh, I don't know, it seems like we just had to leave everything outside the studio, you know, and when we got into the studio, just make the music, and that was the only thing that eased the tension was working continually.
The late John Phillips speaking with Terry Gross in 1986. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave. It's our 60s Music Week. This is Fresh Air. You keep pouring up a wet glass of Beyonce, you're strong.
And now to sing this lovely ballad, here is Mama Cass.
Stars shining bright above you. Night breeze.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Kissing in Manhattan, fiction about love-hungry urbanites by David Chickler, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more of our interview with the late John Phillips, the founder of the Mamas and the Papas, and we meet Neil Young.
I am a child, I last a while. You can't conceive of the pleasure in my smile. You hold my hand, rough up my hair. It's lots of fun to have you there. I gave to you, now you give to me. I'd like to know what you've learned. The sky is blue and so is the sea. What is the color? Is burned. What is the color? You are a man, you understand. You pick me up and you lay me down. down again. You make the rules, you say what's fair. It's lots of fun to have you there.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's 1986 interview with the late John Phillips. He was the producer of one of the landmark events of the 60s music scene, the Monterey Pop Festival. He was also the founder and primary songwriter for the Mamas and the Papas.
You know what's funny to me? You're listening to these records, you say, wow, I bet this group has such a good time together.
We did.
Did you?
Yeah, in sort of an unconventional way.
Uh-huh. Because I'm thinking, like, gosh, you know, you just never know if people are at each other's throats or carrying on behind each other's backs and stuff. And you always think, oh, it just must be great to tour together and so on. And
well, you know, we all lived in the same house for years. And, you know, it was like a communal lifestyle, and it was sort of one of the first LSD communes, you know, that sprang up all over the country. You know, we had our own little commune of four people, and I think we did everything that 30 people could have done had they been there. You know, every combination came forth.
You threw Michelle out of the group for a while. Can you explain the circumstances behind that?
Well, I prefer to think of it as,
yeah,
as, you know, when Michelle, you know, there was a group called the Birds, and a very good songwriter and guitar player and singer, who's a very good friend of mine now also, named Gene Clark, in the group. And Michelle and I had broken up for the umpteenth time, and she was dating Gene, and we were playing at a place called Melody Land out in California. And Simon and Garfunkel with the opening act for us, and it was a big show that night. And Gene was sitting in the front row, and Michelle was playing to Gene, and I really got angry, and I felt very hurt, and I could not overcome my jealousy through you know, mental training. So I just went to Cass and Denny, and I said, "Yeah, I just can't do this anymore. I can't really work under these circumstances." I said, "You know, either Michelle has to go or I have to go." I said, "I'm very willing to go out and form a new group or do anything, you know, but one of us has got to get out of here because it's driving me nuts and I just can't do it." And so they said, "Well, throw her out. Let's get rid of her then." And so we went to the record company, and Lou said, "Well, whatever you guys want to do, you know." And so in Michelle's book, which is out right now, called California Dreamin', she has a picture of the letter, you know, which is signed by everyone, not just by me, Terry. I couldn't keep her out of the group for long anyway, because I was so in love with her. It didn't make me much difference, you know. She was out for, oh, I guess 3 or 4 months tops, I suppose.
What were some of the reasons why you broke up?
Well, there were a couple of reasons. One was the underlying effect of all the different affairs the group members had had with each other and things like that. And the difficulty of men and women living in close quarters, caged animals, you know, sex rearing its ugly head and things like that. And another reason was that we just could not keep up the creativity. We were burned out emotionally from all the tension we had created for ourselves. And we were burned out on LSD. And we were burned out artistically. We had just worked so hard in that 3-year period in the studio, just day after day after day, 18-hour days, under the influence of drugs, and just on and on and on and on, laying on layer after layer of music and voices and new songs and new harmonies and new arrangements. we started to do a fifth album, and we just couldn't match what we had already done at all. Couldn't come close to it. And we realized that if we kept the Mamas and Papas going from then on, it was just going to be a downhill thing.
And you didn't want that to happen.
And we
so
started
you split.
Calling it Downhill Records instead of Dunhill Records. And the writing was on the wall, you know. We said, let's just leave this alone. This was very good, these four albums. Let's not play with it, all right? We'll just go home now.
It seems like you were all starting to go a little berserk at around that time,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, well, you know, when you take that much acid in that short amount of time, you know, we didn't really, we thought everyone was sort of taking it. We went to a fellow named Dr. Cohn in Los Angeles at UCLA, Dennis and I, and because we were like, our nervous systems were like, you know, our hands were shaking and we couldn't eat and things, you know, we were dropping forks and things like that, you know. And he was like, you know, in charge of nervous disorders at UCLA, and he said, well, why are you guys this way? Well, I mean, tell me about an average day for you. So, well, we get up, we take our acid, we said, you do what? You know, we take our acid, and he says, what do you take acid every day? I said, well, not every day, but, you know, like four or five times a week at least, you know. He says, well, how long have you been doing this? I said, well, for 2.5, 3 years. He said, oh, my God, you're lucky you're alive. And then he took us on a tour of his psychiatric ward, and he showed us so many real burnouts, people who did have bad trips and bad experiences who never came back.
Did you stop?
Not immediately, no. We did cut down to once a week, though.
After the Mamas and Papas disbanded, you went through a period of trying to do a Broadway show, of doing, I think, one or two independent records by yourself. But none of that stuff was very commercially successful.
Not at all.
But also around that period in the 1970s, that's when you started shooting up and really getting into hard drugs. What led to that? And I ask that knowing that you'd already seen friends of yours OD on drugs, so you weren't naive about
I wasn't at all naive about
it. And you'd seen what had happened to you from taking all the acid.
Yeah. I don't think that's ever a deterrent, a friend of yours. I mean, a lot of friends of mine had seen a lot of their friends die from drugs, and then they died from drugs. And why I didn't die from drugs, I'll never know. Just luck of the draw, I guess. But I had a string of things that didn't really satisfy me, and starting with the Wolf King album, which I never really I loved the songs I'd written for it, but I didn't like the way I sang on it. I thought it was, you know, I was very depressed. I'd broken up with Michelle again, of course, and I had just started living with Genevieve Waite, the girl I eventually married. And then I got a chance to go to London to do the film score and then to sing the score for The Man Who Fell to Earth, David Bowie film. And I went to London, and I ran into Keith Richard again, and we started living together, and he helped me work on the score, as did Mick Taylor. And Jagger and Richards and I have been friends for years and years and years by that time, you know, 10 years anyway. And Keith was very heavily into heroin at that time. And when we started living together, there was always heroin around the house. And I had become just callous toward drug use, because I'd been doing it for so many years. And it just to watch Keith, you know, Keith somehow was able to maintain on it, you know, and just sort of still do his work and play his music and so forth. And so I started experimenting with it, and so did Genevieve. And next thing I knew, I was addicted to it.
How did you know when you were actually addicted?
My nose started running. You know, my eyes started getting red, and I was feeling clammy in the morning and things like that. And I thought I was getting the flu. And Keith said, no, what you need to fix, you know. And at that moment, I had a decision to make. You know, there was some heroin on the table, and there was a whole world outside, and I took the heroin. And it took me a long time to get over it.
Did it ever get to the point where, like, your sources, you had enough money, at least at the beginning, to buy from people who wouldn't necessarily give you a lot of trouble? You didn't have to go on the streets to buy. But did it ever get to the point where you had to go to, like, shooting galleries and you know, like, really awful street places to get drugs?
Well, not really until, I guess, 1980. I mean, I had a drugstore in New York City that I had an arrangement with the pharmacist there. And so I would just go in there with a shopping bag once a week and take all the drugs off the shelves and pay them twice the retail value and walk off with them. And then when the DEA closed that drugstore down, that's when I did hit the streets and tried to clean up and had that incredible 4th of July weekend when Mick and Jerry Hall came out to visit us in the Hamptons for the weekend. And I tried to burn the house down, and we were going through violent withdrawal, and wrecked my car, and Mick took my kids away from me, wouldn't give them back because I was so crazed at the time. And he was absolutely right, as it turned out. And I was cooking up some heroin in the kitchen of my house and about to inject it, and Mick said, don't you think you're doing a bit much of that, you know? I said, no, I can handle it, no problem. He said, oh, okay. And he walked in, that's all he ever really said about it, but I could feel him sort of withdraw a bit from me, bit by bit, at that time.
If you weren't busted and if you didn't enter a therapy program because of that, do you think you would have stopped on your own?
No, I tried a lot. I tried many times, and I wasn't able to do it. And I never tried it, you know, in a therapeutic situation, an actual hospital or rehab, with intensive, you know, psychiatry and group therapy and things like that. And I don't think that it's a possible thing to do, you know, to kick a hardcore heroin habit by yourself. I don't know anyone to do it yet. And anybody who's interested in a bit of advice, if you have a drug problem, first thing you have to do is identify it, you know, and say, I have a drug problem. And then you have to check in somewhere and get some help. And then comes the real long withdrawal. And it's not just the physical withdrawal, it's the psychological withdrawal that's so difficult.
John Phillips spoke with Terry Gross in 1986. He died last year of a heart attack. Coming up, the godfather of grunge, Neil Young. This is Fresh Air. Neil Young is one of the few musicians whose early records are played on classic rock stations, but whose new records remain vital and exciting. To quote the Rolling Stone Encyclopedia of Rock and Roll, Young is sometimes visionary, sometimes flaky, sometimes both at once. Neil Young was born in 1945 in Toronto and spent much of his youth in Winnipeg. In 1966, he moved to L.A. and teamed up with Stephen Stills and Richie Furay to form the groundbreaking country rock group Buffalo Springfield. After the band split up in 1968, Young did a short stint with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and then formed his own band, Crazy Horse. Over the years, Neil Young has played acoustic music, country rock, and hard driving rock. Terry spoke with him in 1992 when he was associated with the grunge scene.
You know, it's interesting, most of the people who play, you know, that kind of like loud grunge sound are much younger. And I wonder how you felt as somebody in his 40s who's been recording since the mid-60s, playing a music that mostly people who are, you know, a generation or so younger than you.
None of these old guys around know how to do it.
No, the old guys know how to
do it? No, they don't. They can't do it, so, you know, they don't do it. That's why I'm still doing it, because I know how. If they were as lucky as me, they'd be doing it too. I mean, it's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
There's no sensation like that.
What does it feel like?
It feels great. I mean, you're in the middle of this thing. It's all around you. It surrounds you. It's an amazing sound. You know, they started, grunge started before I started playing. I mean, Link Wray started. He was one of the earliest of the of this type of music with a song called Rumble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember.
And several other songs. And he combined with Lonnie Mack, who did Wham! In Memphis back in the early 60s. That was the beginning of this stuff.
You were in high school bands. Did you sing in those bands?
After the beginning, I did. I started as an instrumentalist. We used to do songs, instrumentals that I used to write, you know, melodies and play them on a guitar, sort of like a group called The Shadows from England. And then after the English invasion, you know, and and also about the same time as Jimmy Reed became popular, the old blues man Jimmy Reed with going to New York and...
Bright Lights, Big City.
Yeah, Beeping and Hyde and all these things. You know, about the same time as the British invasion, all these groups singing harmony and playing guitars and everything. Both of those things happened to me at once, so I really couldn't figure out who it was that made me want to sing, but one of them, you know, or both of them at the same time. Then I started singing, and that was like a milestone.
What do you mean?
People couldn't believe it, apparently. I don't remember it, but I was so into it, I guess I didn't notice that everybody was going, what is that? You know, as I was starting to sing. Of course, now I'm like, you know, Caruso or something. Got it down.
Were you self-conscious about your voice when you started to sing?
No, not really. I never really, I was just glad to be singing. I mean, we could do a lot more songs if I sang them.
No one else in the band could sing?
No. Nobody in the band could sing. Not nobody else in the band. Nobody in the band. So we did harmony, and we did everything, you know, but it didn't matter.
Now, you say that you weren't self-conscious about your singing, but there are stories about how, you know, like in your first solo album, you intentionally mixed yourself in the background.
No, I mixed myself right up there where I should be, and then they tried out this new scientific process that they'd invented called the CSG Heiko-Cog process, which is... this unbelievable thing where you can make a stereo record play back on a mono machine just like it was a mono record. They did something to the sound back then. This is when stereo was just coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, you know, a lot of people had mono sets and the stereo didn't sound right on the mono set. So they came out with this thing. You run it through this machine that this guy made, this little box or something. And it would make it so you could play it both stereo or mono. But in reality, I was a test case for this with my first album. They did this without letting me know. And they put it out like that, and I got the pressings back, and I went, what happened, you know? Then I read this thing that had been added on the album cover where this, with this engineering note that this had employed this technique. And really, it was the worst thing I ever heard. I mean, they just buried the whole center of the record and put it way down. And this, I think they only used it on my record. They decided it didn't work after that.
So it wasn't self-consciousness that was behind
it? No. I can look at the next record. My vocal is right up there.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about being in a tight harmony group like Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young?
How did they feel about it? That's the question. It was no longer a tight harmony group.
Do you like being in a harmony like that? I mean, I love your voice. I consider it a very personal voice. Do you know what I mean? A voice that should be singing on its own more so than just like mixed in a harmony.
Well, you know, so I like singing harmony too. I sing good harmony with Crazy Horse.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sense in there that, you know, because there's a couple of different ways to sing harmony, you know, and you can, or blends of all of them. But one of them is just real tight harmony, and the other one is where everybody's singing just more or less just singing loose, but in a harmonic structure with a lot of feeling. That's a different kind of harmony, and that's the kind of harmony that I do with Crazy Horse quite a bit. Sometimes we're real successful at that.
Neil Young speaking with Terry Gross. We'll hear more of their conversation after this break. This is Fresh Air.
There is a town in North Ontario.
In my mind, I still need a place to go. All my changes were there. Blue, blue windows behind the stars.
Back now to Terry's 1992 interview with Neil Young.
Something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Being wrong, nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound?
So you came from Canada to Los Angeles, became part of Buffalo Springfield, and I guess it was in 66 you have a really big hit, For What It's Worth. And then, you know, people just like love Buffalo Springfield. This is like the height or the beginnings of the height of the whole kind of counterculture, which is really thriving, particularly on the West Coast. And so suddenly, like, you're really in the thick of it. I mean, you'd gone from what, a small town in Canada, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a 500,000 people, something like that.
Uh-huh. And now, like, you're really in the thick of it. Did you change a lot? Were you like a kind of different person than you were?
Well, you know, I think it affected me. I think it got to be a lot of pressure for a while, but, you know, we got through that after freaking out and quitting the band a couple of times and, you know, throwing my guitar against the chair and doing all kinds of stuff. You know, we went through a normal kind of teenage to adult changeover period there.
When you throw your guitar against the chair, in the days when you did that, were you sure you had money to replace it?
No, that was the point. No. No, I think I didn't do that every day, but it's just part, I guess, the pressure of being in the band and trying to make things happen. Yeah. We did a lot of things like that. I mean, what, we were 20, 21 years old. We were kind of crazy for a while, and then, you know, just like anybody else, under a lot of pressure. Bunch of kids, and, you know, it was a pretty fast-moving time.
What's something that you look back on and still find really exciting about that period?
Well, the music was great, and it's too bad it was never recorded correctly, or it would have been, you know, the Buffalo Springfield would have been far more of a memory than they are now.
What's missing?
The music is missing. There was, you know, this was about the time when people started making records by overdubbing, and new technology was coming in. We had like 8 tracks, and you know, big. We had ways of doing things that weren't that made it possible to layer records, and so instead of going in the studio and singing live, like we were so great live, the people producing us, they didn't record us the way they should have. If they had just set us up and let us record live, this band would be. Band probably would have been together and stayed together a lot longer, because we would have had much more success and had a lot more happiness from listening to our records, and, you know, felt like we were getting something done. But at the beginning, it was kind of hard to break through. We still didn't know how to make records, and we didn't have anybody that knew how to make records helping us make records. And instead, we had people who wanted to be record producers for one reason or another, who were there, but they really weren't doing anything. Nobody strong came along and said, listen, you guys go in there and sing, and when I tell you to come out and stop playing and singing, then come on in here and it'll sound great. Nobody ever did that. So I feel that was a failing of the Buffalo Springfield, was all the records. There was only Ahmet Erdogan really had a grip on what should be what the Springfield records should sound like.
What sounds best to you now from those records?
I don't have a favorite.
Okay. I thought I'd play Mr. Soul. What are your memories of that?
Well, the memories of that are the best take of it and the best mix of it and the best version of it is somewhere in the Atlantic vault.
Right.
And the one that we're listening to here is one that where we got away from it and we kept overdubbing and overdubbed guitar parts and added things over top of the original stuff and lost some of the original stuff. And we took it too far. We didn't have anybody to tell us to go home or tell us that had experience telling us what to do. So we lost a lot of the great stuff that we had on tape in the first place, or that we never got a lot of it on tape at all.
Okay. Well, in the meantime, we'll satisfy ourselves with the actually released version of Mr. Soul.
Neil Young, recorded in 1992. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Yeah, come on.
On the next Fresh Air, we wrap up our 60s week special with Ray Manzarek, the Doors keyboard player, and John Fogerty, who got his start with Creedence Clearwater Revival. Join us for the next Fresh Air.